This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 8, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. In a closed session, the Senate Intelligence Committee passes the Patriot Act Reauthorization Act. Activists organize against the NAFTA superhighway set to facilitate trade between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. And we'll take a look at what happens when high schools resist military recruiters. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, the streets of La Paz were relatively quiet. Miners, laborers, and other social groups are marching to Bolivia's capital. Luis Gomez has more from La Paz.
It's expected that Sucre is going to be full blockade tomorrow morning before the Congress starts its session. President Mesa resigned on Monday, but yesterday he asked to the President of the Congress not to succeed him as is a mandate for the Constitution, because Mesa said last night it will break apart the country into a civil war. Around 1 in the morning, Armando Bacadíez, the President of the Congress, replied to Mesa that he is willing to take power and confirm a new government according to the right-wing party's desires. They're going to negotiate this night. Right now, the Aymara peasants are traveling 16 hours, and the miners are doing so. So the confrontation is going to start tomorrow morning in Sucre.
That was Free Speech Radio News correspondent Luis Gomez in La Paz. Military spending worldwide has exceeded $1 trillion. Kate Pallman reports from D.C.
For the first time since the Cold War, world spending on military defense has crossed the $1 trillion mark, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The United States is the largest spender, using the so-called War on Terrorism to justify adding another $238 billion to the Defense Department. That money, says Frida Berrigan, senior research associate at the World Policy Institute, does little to help the American public.
So people lose out in a big way when the United States prioritizes the military over everything else.
The General Accounting Office reports that the Defense Department barely gets a passing grade in terms of business skills, giving the department a D-. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Kate Pallman.
Textile workers in Mexico are putting pressure on toy company Mattel to investigate the working conditions at a plant that manufactures Barbie's wardrobe. Shannon Young files this report from Oaxaca.
Workers from a plant licensed to make clothing for Barbie dolls protested in front of Mattel's Mexican headquarters yesterday, demanding resolution of a labor dispute that has been simmering since April. Mattel tried to distance itself from the matter by saying that the plant where the workers were once employed is only related to Mattel through a license that permits the plant to manufacture doll clothing using the Barbie logo. The labor dispute stems from a massive layoff, which occurred as union representation for a collective bargaining contract was under question. The textile plant has also been accused of multiple cases of exploitation of child labor. But Ruby's, the plant in question, has characterized the situation as a dispute between rival unions. La Jornada reports that at yesterday's protest at Mattel's offices, a union representative called on Mattel to allow an independent investigation of the labor conditions of those who clothe their Barbies. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
Farm workers have sued the Environmental Protection Agency, accusing the governmental watchdog of shirking their duty on deadly pesticides. Brian Edwards-Tiekert reports from KPFA in Berkeley.
In the lawsuit, half a dozen advocacy groups claim the EPA has an obligation under the Food Quality Protection Act to make sure its standards for pesticides in food protect vulnerable populations. Margaret Reeves is a senior scientist at Pesticide Action Network. She says the millions of children who live on or near farms are already overexposed.
They're kids, and they're more vulnerable than adults. And on top of that, they're among the farm and farm working community who has the greatest exposures to pesticides.
The EPA said in a written statement that it believes its standards do protect children's health. But Reeves says the agency has ignored a petition requesting that it examine risks to farm worker children in particular. The stakes are high. If the EPA considers those risks, it might lower the permissible level of pesticides in all food. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
A billboard linking George W. Bush with Osama bin Laden went up in Connecticut and met a largely positive reaction. Melinda Tuhus has more from New Haven.
Artist and high school teacher Jerry Allison got a small grant to put his message on a billboard for a month. It shows photos of George Bush and Osama bin Laden wearing each other's clothes, with the words, 21st century weapons, 11th century ideas, a better world is possible. It's bordered by symbols of religion and war. The billboard struck a positive chord with several passersby. The billboard, at street level, was slightly vandalized a few days ago, but Allison, the artist, says he's gotten nothing but positive feedback from many people who contacted him after seeing it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The body responsible for monitoring human rights in Europe, the Council of Europe, has released a report today which heavily criticizes Britain's human rights record under Tony Blair's Labour government. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Central to the European Council's report is criticism of Britain's anti-terror laws, many of which they say are incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights, which Britain is signed up to. The Council criticises laws such as house arrest for terrorist suspects and the decision that intelligence obtained under torture can be accepted as evidence in court, provided the torture wasn't committed or connived at by British officials. Many say this report should force the government to bring their lawmaking closer in line with their obligations to European human rights law. But human rights lawyer Michael Schwartz isn't holding his breath.
Many lawyers were very pleased when this government brought in the Human Rights Act shortly after it was elected in 1997. The trouble is that everything, or many things, the government has done since then have sought to undermine that progressive step. And at times the government, for example through terrorist legislation, seems willfully to close its eyes to the implications on human rights of many pieces of its legislation. Every piece of legislation that goes through Parliament is supposed to be vetted in advance for compliance with the European Convention on Human Rights. In fact, ministers are supposed to sign it off as compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights and the Human Rights Act.
The report also attacks a wide range of what it sees as oppressive British laws. Barrister and member of the European Council of Liberty, Professor Bill Bowring, isn't surprised.
Anti-terror legislation is not the only dangerous tendency in Britain at the present time. One also has the immigration and asylum legislation, the proposals on identity cards, tagging, the fact that we are the most surveilled society in Western Europe, all of which pose a threat to civil liberties. And of course, the extreme example of that is the statement by the leader of the Conservative Party that if they come to power, they are intending to denounce not only the Refugee Convention, but also the European Convention on Human Rights and to repeal the Human Rights Act. Now, that would be an extremely drastic step. But I think it's a sign of the sort of climate which exists, and that there are absolutely similar tendencies in France, Germany and other EU countries as well.
Labour Member of Parliament John McDonnell says even the way the Labour government has forced anti-terror and other legislation through Parliament is itself undemocratic.
The best example is the guillotine motions, although guillotines and motions have always existed, and Mrs. Thatcher was a devil for introducing them. Nevertheless, this government has introduced more guillotine motions than Thatcher ever thought of or ever dreamt of. We can go through the pieces of legislation, have debates in the House of Commons, like the Serious Organised Crime Bill, whereby half the bill was not even debated within the Commons, because the guillotine motion never allowed us to reach those elements of the bill. So we're rushing legislation through, most of which has not been considered properly.
Professor Bill Bowring again.
What we've seen over the past 5 or 6 years is time after time the government being condemned in the courts for unlawful behaviour in a particular violation of human rights standards. So I think we can certainly expect to see even greater tension between the courts and the government. And the problem we have in Britain is that we don't have a written constitution. And at the end of the day, the government is able to overrule the courts at whatever level. But of course, once that starts happening, as we've already seen on the question of indefinite detention, then you get a real crisis developing.
And it's a crisis set to deepen if the British government departs any further from its obligations under the European Convention. Member of Parliament John McDonnell again.
I think the main way in which we can try and halt and arrest this decline in the undermining of civil liberties in particular is mobilisation within individual communities of groups coming together and just standing firm and saying we're not willing to tolerate this anymore. That being mobilised on an individual basis in some instances for people to challenge for their particular rights within the courts, particularly within the European courts. In addition to that, communities coming together locally and nationally to wage what is a campaign for restoration of democratic rights in this country.
This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush was questioned about the so-called Downing Street memo for the first time yesterday during a joint press conference with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The memo, which was leaked to the British press before Blair's bid for re-election, suggests that Bush and Blair planned to attack Iraq before the proposal was made public. President Bush.
Well, I read kind of the characterizations of the memo, particularly when they dropped it out in the middle of his race. This meeting, you know, evidently that took place in London, happened before we even went to the United Nations, or I went to the United Nations. And so it's, both of us didn't want to use our military. Nobody wants to commit military into combat. It's the last option. The consequences of committing the military are very difficult.
David Swanson is the co-founder of the AfterDowningStreet.org coalition, which is attempting to gather 250,000 signatures on a petition calling on Bush to provide additional information about the memo. Swanson points out that neither Bush nor Blair deny the memo or the meeting.
The fact that the meeting took place months before they went to the United Nations and months before the president went to Congress is precisely the point. You'll notice that the Prime Minister said in no uncertain terms the memo was written. Neither one of them questioned its authenticity. Neither one of them dismissed it as an inaccurate recording of that meeting or as a forgery or a mistake. They both acknowledged the memo and acknowledged the meeting, but they disputed some of the key points made in it, specifically that the facts were being fixed around the policy and that the decision had already been made to go to war. But those facts are laid out in the memo, and neither the Prime Minister nor the President has presented any evidence to the contrary.
Swanson adds that his group is looking for a single lawmaker in the House of Representatives to introduce a resolution of inquiry, directing the House Judiciary Committee to launch a formal investigation into whether sufficient grounds exist for the House to impeach the president. Meanwhile, in a closed session, the Senate Intelligence Committee passed the Patriot Act Reauthorization Act. Along with making about half of the provisions of the act that are set to expire permanent, the measure would also expand the FBI's authority to subpoena records without a court order and track people's mail. The measure still has to go through one more Senate committee before the entire Senate votes on the bill. Mitch Jezerich has more from Washington.
Kit Cage, the director of the National Committee Against Oppressive Legislation, has been monitoring the activities of the FBI and CIA for over 30 years. She says she sees parallels between the FBI's covert activities against such groups as the Black Panther Party and anti-war organizations during the 1970s and the current push on Capitol Hill to give more authority to the FBI to subpoena documents without a court or grand jury order.
You know, increasingly we're talking about associational crimes. People who associate with or who have politics that are up in opposition to what the government feels is proper. It's a long time problem. It dates, you know, back to certainly the beginning of the 20th century, but here we now have it much more codified, much more approved by the law, and the new Patriot provisions are going to further have us go down that road where the government doesn't have to connect anyone to crime before it can do massive invasion of their privacy.
Gage says as the FBI is given broader authority to investigate so-called national security issues, that people who are not involved in any terrorist activity whatsoever will get caught up in its net.
Problem now is that people who are doing, you know, who aren't really suspected of any criminal activity, the government can go and do fishing expeditions. And then find out, oh, here's some marijuana. Oh, here's some, you know, evidence. You know, here's their finances, and we think they're engaged in tax evasion or whatever.
After hours of secret debate on Tuesday afternoon, the Senate Intelligence Committee passed the Patriot Act reauthorization by 11-4 vote. At the last open hearing, before the committee began debating the bill in private, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden urged that the markup sessions and vote be held in public.
It seems to me that there is so much that we have to do in closed session because of the implications for national security that that's appropriate, but I don't think that's the case here.
But the Republican chair of the committee, Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas, denied Wyden's request, saying that he wanted a better understanding of the bill that could only be done in a closed session.
I intend to ask questions event-oriented that deal with classified information from the intelligence community on how the Patriot Act actually works.
The measure makes permanent about 9 provisions that deal with intelligence matters, including Section 215 that gives FBI access to business and library records, Section 201 that allows roving wiretaps, and Section 213 that allows for delayed notice search warrants. The prospect of passing the measure has improved as the ranking Democrat on the committee, Jay Rockefeller, voted for it on Tuesday. Still, Rockefeller says he will seek to amend the measure as it makes its way through Congress.
I support reauthorizing the Patriot Act, and I'm inclined to support adding investigative authorities, but only if it can be shown that these new authorities are necessary and would not infringe on the constitutional rights of Americans.
The Bush administration argues that the expanded authority is necessary.
We don't just investigate the guilty. We end up investigating a lot of people who turn out to be innocent.
Deputy Attorney General James Comey testified today to the House Judiciary Committee, where he said the FBI needs speedy access to information so not to miss an attempt to capture a dangerous person.
If you raise the threshold to make it more challenging, you have to make a higher showing to get basic records, you're going to thwart a lot of investigation you don't want to thwart. If you saw someone in a restaurant in animated conversation with a Muhammad Atta, what do you know about that person? Not much, but you want to know an awful lot. And if the threshold is raised that you have to have some baseline facts before you can start gathering baseline facts, you've thwarted investigation in a way that I don't think any of us want.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
A push for immigration reform was heralded today when the National Farm Workers Alliance and a bipartisan group of members of Congress came out in support of new immigration legislation. The Ag Jobs Bill that may come up for a vote this session would grant temporary and then permanent immigration status to agricultural workers. Jenny Johnson has more from D.C.
Having a dependable job force in the agriculture industry is something that both industry and immigrants' rights groups can agree on, it seems. United Farm Workers spokesman Mark Grossman explains the 3-year compromise that went into creating the Ag Jobs Bill.
Both growers and farm workers face a similar dilemma. Growers say that they want a workforce that is legal and stable. They realize that if the government were to enforce the immigration laws, that the majority of their workforce would be taken away. Farm workers need some protection, some ability to come out of the shadows of fear and be able to assert their rights in the society that they help feed.
The Ag Jobs Bill is an immigration bill. The earned legalization that it calls for would permit a temporary immigration status for some undocumented workers that have been contributing to U.S. agriculture. If they continue to work in agriculture for the following 3 to 6 years, they could become permanent citizens. A leading opponent of the bill blames the agriculture industry for lobbying intensively through the Chamber of Commerce to obtain congressional backing for the bill. Craig Nelson is the executive director of Project USA.
They're giving away a gift of citizenship, which is not theirs to give away. They didn't have anything to do with creating the desirability of the United States as a place to live. That we're allowing these corporations to peddle our citizenship and our place as a nation away so that they can increase their profit margins is obscene.
Grossman of United Farm Workers disagrees that this has a negative impact on the economy. He describes the plight of migrant workers that legal status in the United States would help alleviate.
Last summer, a table grape worker in Kern County died from heat exposure. They move from place to place. Housing is abysmal. Living conditions are miserable. They're frequently separated from their families for years and years at a time. So undocumented farm workers in particular endure conditions and abuse that other American workers would never tolerate.
Both sides also respectively believe the bill will pass or fail if it comes to vote this session. Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
With opposition to military recruitment on the rise, high schools who take a stand against recruiters on campus find themselves doubly challenged, not only by pro-military forces around the country, but by the No Child Left Behind federal law, which requires that public schools give military recruiters the same access to high school students as college recruiters or lose federal funding. Garfield High School is one such school in Seattle caught in the middle of the growing conflict. Martha Baskin has more.
On the last day military recruiters were scheduled to visit Garfield High for the school year, the district was braced for the worst. The school requested a police presence in the activity center where three Air Force and one National Guard were positioned and barred the media from the room. The result? Amadou Sek, a junior, describes the scene to this reporter.
I just came from the activity center, and basically there's no students in there unless they're buying candy or sodas from the vending machines, but there's not really talking to the Army people or anything like that.
Career counselor Karen Engstrom arranges visits from the military, employers, and colleges. She says she saw one student fill out a form for the Air Force, and other students pick up pencils and mugs, but not fill out cards for follow-up.
The poor National Guard, every time he comes, his face just falls because nobody wants to join up because they're the ones who are being targeted to go over there.
Engstrom tries to present a balanced set of options, such as AmeriCorps, the Peace Corps, or community service offered by the Quakers.
The problem is they do not have the recruiters like the military. So to ask them to come in every time the military shows up is a hardship on them.
Like other schools around the country, the Garfield High community has put the military on high alert. A youth-led counter-recruitment rally shut down the nearby Army Recruiting Center a few weeks ago. In May, the school's Parent-Teacher-Student Association voted to ban military recruiters from the school, and later demonstrated a willingness to confront recruiters face-to-face when they came on site. Amy Hagopian, co-chair of the PTSA, described her conversation with a Marine.
He was trying to tell me that he could offer students safe positions in the Marines where they would not be in harm's way. And that's just patently false. They can't. PTA's mission is to advance the health and welfare of kids. That's what we do. And having military recruiters in a public high school implies an endorsement of that product.
The problem faced by communities who'd like to ban military recruiters, or at least see their visits curtailed, is the four-year-old federal law, No Child Left Behind. Although the Garfield PTSA voted to ban military recruiters from the school, the Seattle School District could not okay the ban without losing some $15 million in federal education funds. The pressure on the district has come from other quarters as well. When Amy Hagopian, the PTSA, parents, students, and teachers confronted the military last month, the event became a lightning rod for pro-military forces around the country. Hagopian, the school, and the district were deluged with hundreds and hundreds of right-wing hate mail, including death threats and racial epithets. Again, Amy Hagopian.
Everybody was buried in this very unpleasant hate mail, and it made people very uncomfortable. And it intimidated many people, especially people who weren't particularly supportive of the position. This was not a unanimous position. And so my guess is that the principal is under pressure to make this calm down.
Corporal Jason Fry, approached in the school parking lot after the session, says recruitment hasn't been too bad.
It's better in some places than other places. Around Seattle, it's not as great as it was down like in Kent area. They're pretty good. But we're getting along.
But with spokespeople from the Air Force not returning numerous phone calls and national recruiting 42% below goals for April, it's hard to say just how long the military will get along. Emily Riley with the youth-led Recruiter Free Seattle plans on making the military's job as difficult as possible.
We don't want anyone else to be recruited into the armed services from our city. And so we're going to be doing firing and education wherever they are, at job fairs, you know, when they show up to entertainment events. We are going to be hopefully as hot on their tail as possible and making sure that an alternate view is also heard.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
A new interstate known as the NAFTA Superhighway would stretch from the Mexican border through the Midwest and up to Canada. The highway would facilitate trade between these countries. Still largely in the planning phases, I-69 has already generated wide controversy. In Boston, Helen Matthews has more. The U.S. government is currently poised to roll out a new strip of asphalt all the way from Laredo, Texas, up to Port Huron, Michigan. Interstate 69, if completed, will stretch over 2,000 miles through Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Michigan. The main purpose of this interstate is to provide a channel for trading goods between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. It would act as a piece of the life support system for the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, and, if enacted, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. In Mexico, another highway is in the works. It's part of a project known as Plan Puebla Panama. This highway would run from the Mexican state of Puebla directly to Panama. Supporters of fair trade point out that the combination of I-69 and the proposed Mexican highway would complete a highway system that deepens the reach of North American corporations into Mesoamerica. This highway system would funnel goods from Mexican sweatshops to North American consumers, as the corridor along the Plan Puebla Panama Highway is likely to give rise to a rash of factories called maquiladoras. Maquiladoras are export-oriented and typically foreign-owned. They are known for their low wages, long hours, and harsh working conditions. Catherine Stecher of the Campaign for Labor Rights in D.C. explains.
Plan Puebla Panama is a development plan that's being promoted by mainly the U.S. and Mexico. And a part of it is to open up and create an infrastructure that will allow for more free movement of capital. So yes, in effect, its goal is to create more maquilas and more cheap production. I think maquilas most likely right now will begin to spring up more in southern Mexico. The highway itself will be used to transport these goods into the U.S.
Many Mexicans have been organizing to stop the Plan Puebla Panama Highway, among them the Zapatistas. In the U.S., Midwesterners are launching a summer-long campaign to bring I-69 to an end. The campaign is called Roadless Summer. By stopping this highway, they hope to ultimately disrupt the use of cheap Mexican labor for export by U.S.-based multinational companies. But they're also concerned about the local damage from the highway. A segment of I-69 that would run from Evansville, Indiana, to Indianapolis is the focus of Roadless Summer. I spoke with Nick Keener of the Hoosier Environmental Council.
5,100 acres of farmland would be lost, 1,600 acres of forest, 140 acres of wetlands, for a total of 7,000 acres of Indiana lost to I-69.
If this fraction of the interstate in Indiana is stopped, the rest of it is unlikely to be built, says Uma, an organizer with Roadless Summer.
This section of the highway is vital to the rest of the construction. It's the time-saving segment. There are already major highways connecting Mexico to Canada, but this particular section will save 238 trucking hours for each and every truck, and truckers get paid by the mile. It's only the corporations that would benefit from this. More importantly, it's too expensive for most states along the route to invest in the construction of a highway that won't benefit residents and local businesses, and that will cut through many communities and devastate surrounding environments. As of now, Texas is the only other state drawing out plans for construction.
The Roadless Summer campaign will embrace a variety of activities and tactics, including demonstrations, a bike tour of the proposed highway route, a training camp for student activists, and mass direct action. The campaign kicked off on Saturday, June 4th, with a demonstration in Indianapolis. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Helen Matthews in Boston.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.